the cold marble-like guy who you have to die to be with. Like, you basically can't be alive and be with him. They just don't go together.
Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Some of you may remember Team Edward versus Team Jacob. And some of you, well, some of us, may not so much remember as have become a little obsessed with wolves and werewolves and what they mean about how we see ourselves as humans and as animals that we may have binge-watched all the Twilight movies and then had to talk about it with one of our best friends. Okay, let's start over again. This is going to be an atypical episode, which is why I'm recording it as a bonus episode. One of the things I've really been wanting to do in this podcast is to analyze some popular culture, whatever it is that's out there that sort of subliminally says something about how we feel about ourselves and our relationship to the natural world. So this is kind of a first trial, a first pancake, if you will. I'd love to know what you think of it. Send me an email to share your thoughts at askwith, that's A-S-Q-U-I-T-H, .intheweeds@gmail.com. A couple of things you should know. We're going to be talking about the Twilight films based on the novels by Stephenie Meyer that came out between 2008 and 2012. The main characters are a teenage girl named Bella who falls in love with a handsome, aloof boy named Edward, who turns out to be not just a reclusive high school student, but in fact a 104-year-old vampire, and a werewolf named Jacob who also vies for Bella's love. Thus, the Team Edward versus Team Jacob, which was a successful marketing ploy for the later movies. My friend and I agree that at this stage in our life, at least, we don't understand why Bella would ever go for the cold-blooded vampire over the sexy, warm-blooded wolf, Jacob. But, spoiler alert, Bella chooses the vampire. And speaking of spoiler alerts, we're going to be referring to events over the course of the films, so you're duly warned. This episode will continue some of the themes that we discussed in the two previous episodes, The Wolf in the Woods and In the Company of Actual Wolves. I think at the heart of this inquiry for me is the question of how we use predators, and I use the example of the wolf because the wolf seems particularly interesting, particularly gripping. But how do we use predators to understand who we are as humans and who we are as animals, and how these two relate to each other? So, as I alluded to in the beginning, I'm going to be talking to a close friend of mine. Her name is Elisa Hartz. She's amply qualified to have this sort of conversation. She has a PhD in comparative literature as well as a law degree. Of course, we were also just having fun. But sometimes having fun is the best way to reveal hidden truths.
One thing I watched it again last night, and I was thinking about how obsessed she is with her age, and it comes to be about objectifying herself for him so that she doesn't live and grow and change over time.
Right. She's very obsessed with her age and the idea that she's going to be a year or two older than him. There's a lot of emphasis on physical beauty. I read a little bit of the first one, and she's just obsessed with how beautiful he is. So I think part of the dichotomy there is between physical beauty, like visual beauty, and also smell. Apparently his breath smells really good.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because I would think that Jacob would be more associated with smell. Like they at least the vampires talk about him having, you know, smelling like a dog, and
they can
smell him on her, and that kind of, it seems like what you were saying about the visual beauty, like she has a very distanced relationship with the vampires. It's dangerous for them to touch her, and you know, they're cold and object like. It's more like look, don't touch, because touch is dangerous.
Right. So it's almost like, I mean, you wonder if the smell is experienced somehow in a different way. It's like a different kind of smell than the smell of dog, right? Which is this very earthy bodily thing. I can't remember there really being a description of Edward's smell, but it's like this different aesthetic dimension, right? Like,
yeah.
It's like aesthetic beauty that is somehow divorced from embodied nature.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, do you think that Edward and Jacob are culture versus nature?
Well, I think it all gets kind of mixed up in this. It's like these ingredients that have been around for a really long time are put into a blender. They're blended together because I don't think it's that clear cut. I was thinking about fairy tales a lot, and I was thinking about the different fairy tales that I feel echoes of in it. So one is Little Red Riding Hood, and I think that Edward is more the wolf in that sense because of the association of sex and death, basically, you know, because of the idea that the wolf is going to consume her as a sexual predator and that that's sort of equivalent to death in some way. And then I also thought there were overtones of Beauty and the Beast. In the book, there's a lot more emphasis put on the vampires hunting. And I was always struck in the Beauty and the Beast story by the idea that the beast is ashamed about consuming meat. You know, that's something that he doesn't want. Actually, she's Bella too, right? So there's like a clear connection there. The beast doesn't want Belle to see him eat. And I feel like there's kind of a similar thing with the vampire too. So in some ways, well, I guess the way I would put it is that Edward is a predator, right? But he's a predator that is in some weird way kind of divorced from nature too. What do you think?
He's a vegetarian predator.
He's not a vegetarian. Well, they jokingly call themselves vegetarian.
They call themselves as vegetarian. They call themselves vegetarians, and they say you're a vegetarian basically if you don't eat humans, which is what they want to eat. And right. She's a vegetarian too. But it's interesting that the wolf is not at all presented as a predator. The Jacob character is more of a protector, and they don't hunt. They don't seem to hunt. It's a little. There's some storyline where they're killing humans, the wolves are killing humans, but it doesn't seem like quite like hunting. It's more about the violence than the predation per se.
Right. No, they eat human foods. Like there are scenes of them eating
muffins. Human food.
Yeah, which is weird.
It's really weird.
I'm not.
But what
you're
saying, what you were saying about the fairy tales is really interesting because I think that makes total sense that the fairy tales that you're referring to, but also Bella goes and gets the book of Native American stories, which contains the story of the vampires and the wolves and the history of the tribe who become wolves. And then at some point she says, maybe all the stories are true. And I think she's referring to that book, but the vampires are so associated with Europe and Italy specifically, and almost the Renaissance church. And, you know, the Cullen's house is full of books. And every time Cullens appear, practically, there's opera playing. And I agree, they're totally encompassed in the fairy tales, but they're also kind of divorced from them in a different way from the stories that Jacob tells her.
What do you mean that they're divorced from them?
Well, that the fairy tales aren't the stories that the Cullens are telling. It's the story that they're part of, but not their frame. Yeah. For the world, whereas
Jacob's storytelling is a part of who he is. Is that partly what you mean? Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
and he tells her the first thing Jacob tells her practically is the story of the tribe that they were descended from wolves. Like he tells her right from the beginning, and she just thinks it's a story. But
and
you
that
know,
itself
that,
is,
that is who
is
he
an
is.
Embodied tradition too, right? It's storytelling as opposed to these books. And these things that are kind of more abstracted and less a part of lived existence. I hadn't thought about the European thing as much, but that's an interesting point. Because I think the fact that Jacob is Native American has all kinds of, it's like hashtag environmentalism, hashtag, you know, like, you know, connection to the land. Like there are all kinds of sort of cultural tags, I think, that we automatically associate it with the fact that he's Native American. And in that sense, it seems significant that, the vampires are much more European. The Renaissance part of it is kind of interesting. What's the name of the head vampires?
Like the Valtieri.
And that sounds, it does sound like names that have been plucked out of, Renaissance Italy.
Yeah.
Funny.
And the robes that they wear, like they're very, they look like the Medici's or something.
Right,
When he goes into the tribunal to try to die. But so you have the American, and it's interesting that it's set in the Pacific Northwest because you have these transplants into the vampires seem kind of out of place in the forest And yet that's also where they fall in love. She and Edward fall in love. But it's much more the domain of Jacob.
The natural setting seems a very important part of the love story. And yet I found it frustrating at the same time because it felt gratuitous to me, the ways in which it's used. Like when she becomes a vampire, one of the scenes that struck me is that when she becomes a vampire in the last movie, there's a scene where she's hunting. And as she's running through the forest, she zooms in on certain animals and insects as if she's suddenly kind of tuned into the natural world. I mean, there's a sense in which it's beautiful and kind of interesting because it seems like her attentiveness to the natural world is a function of the fact that she's now a hunter. But there's another sense in which it feels gratuitous to me. I don't know, like for instance, whenever they go into one of their magical, like the house that's made for them or the place where they have their honeymoon, they walk in and all the lamps are on and there are candles on all over the place. I don't know why that bothered me. Why do you have to be using so much electricity? Where's the electricity coming from?
Well, that is like Beauty and the Beast too, candles. Right?
Yeah. I mean, it's right. It's we're in the realm of magic. So to sort of be picky about details like that is a little ridiculous, but.
Well, it's interesting. She's from the desert. She's from Arizona. And the first thing that happens when she gets to the Pacific Northwest is that she says that she likes sunshine. And of course, vampires can't stand this. Like the vampires are there because of the cloud cover and the climate in the Pacific Northwest. But like, that's not her climate.
Yeah. So what do we make of her choice? I feel like there are different ways to account for it. One is the fact that it's a teenage romance. I feel like that's important because only a teenager is going to pick the bloodless vampire over the over the sexy werewolf simply because he's good looking, right? Like, I feel like on some level to a teenager, maybe the fact that she can't have sex with him is reassuring.
Yeah, maybe she doesn't want to really.
It's all about the drama.
I mean, I think you're right that it's a teenage story and that explains a lot of it. But I feel like the obsession with aging and with preserving herself at her current age is not really a teenage fantasy. Like that's not really, or at least it wasn't my experience at that age that I was concerned about like being young forever. I just kind of assumed that I would be. Mm-hmm. And this is like, because this is kind of literalizing that desire, it seems like it's imposed from a older age. But
well, I think part of what's troubling about it from a teenage perspective is that she's so desperate to be loved by him, you know.
Yeah.
As a mother of a girl who's rushing a little bit too quickly towards teenagehood, that part of it I found upsetting.
It's also disturbing because like it's like he can't accept her as a woman. I mean, it's hard not to see the blood as being about, you know, a woman. So a woman, mm-hmm. a live woman has blood in her veins, but also menstruates. And that blood just, you know, drives him crazy, like makes him I'm not saying her menstrual blood drives him crazy. Although it did occur to me, like what happens when she gets her period?
Yeah.
Like, does that provoke the vampires? Whereas for Jacob, the blood is just, he said, it's just blood. It's no big deal. You know, it's just warm. He accepts her as an animal, right. A live animal in a way that is life affirming. And I don't really understand why she doesn't choose him. What's your theory?
I'm not sure I have one. I mean, it's making me sad thinking about it because there's a sense in which animal life loses out. I guess that's part of what I meant when I said I felt like the nature stuff is gratuitous because the fact that she does choose to be a vampire necessarily divorces her from that world, except for the fact that, you know, she's going to suck blood from a mountain lion. I don't know. And then there's also the way in which it becomes a superhero movie at the end, and I don't know that I have anything interesting to say about superheroes, but they you know, by the time you've gone through the fourth movie and you've had to see her drained of all her energy and looking skeletal and horrible and with that frightening pregnancy, you're just desperate for her to turn into a vampire. I mean, that seems to be clearly to me why they had to have that movie. Because the first three movies is like, is she gonna, you know, don't turn into a vampire, don't you? And then you're like, turn into a vampire.
Please, yeah. Well, one interesting thing in the later movies is how the wolf, Jacob, becomes like, it almost becomes the Jungle Book. Like the wolf becomes the father figure, the nurturing father for the baby. And, you know, raising, doesn't he kind of raise the baby somewhat? Or
well, he imprints on her. So she's going to be his mate. And she is this sort of hybrid because she's half vampire, half human. So she has various magical qualities. She's immortal, essentially, and yet warm-blooded. She can eat real food or blood. So I guess she's sort of the best of both worlds in that respect. She doesn't have to worry about aging.
And she's bonded to the wolf.
But yeah, I agree. Jacob's presence, I mean, it's a weird compromise just from a narrative point of view. But I'm struck by his presence in that last movie because after he imprints on her, he goes wherever she goes. And in the end, she ends up being able to stay with her family. But there's this idea that she's going to maybe have to run away with Jacob to be safe. And his presence, it's like those scenes where, like the scene in the tent where Jacob has to lie next to Bella to keep her from freezing to death because he's warm-blooded. Mm-hmm. It feels like you need that warm-bloodedness around just for general comfort, even if you've chosen to become a vampire. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's like that part can't be severed.
So is Jacob consistent with what you know about other werewolves? Is he the kind of type of the werewolf?
Well, he's consistent with an earlier type of werewolf. I mean, the Hollywood werewolf, which apparently was really created in the 20th century, doesn't have any precedence or really that much link to the past. I don't even know all of the tropes, but, you know, the business with the silver bullets and all that turns into a werewolf and is kind of a hybrid form. But in the earlier iterations, going back even to pre-Christian times, but then also during the witch trials, which is when the kind of werewolf theme reemerges, a werewolf is essentially a man, usually a man, who turns into a wolf. So in that sense, he's consistent with that.
And is he a positive figure?
The werewolf?
Yeah.
No, generally. Well, I mean, I think that there are some versions of positive figures if you go far enough back. What I need to learn more about is the Native American mythology around the wolf. Mm-hmm. I think they're trying to evoke that loosely,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But I think in the Nordic tradition, for instance, the wolf is associated with the hunt and with a kind of virility. And then in the post-Christian era or the Christian era, one of the things that I thought was interesting was that the predator becomes a problematic figure. One of the motifs that circulates a lot in Christianity is that of the wolf and the sheep. And the wolf isn't the devil per se, but Christ is sometimes the lamb. Christ is sometimes the shepherd guarding its flock, or the church guards the flock. And so the predator is seen very much in a negative light. Whereas I think Jacob harkens more to an earlier association with the wolf, earlier and later, with the current environmental awareness, I think, is at play.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So one of the things we mentioned before when we were chatting is the house that the Cullens live in, which I think is really interesting too. Do you have any thoughts about that? The glass modernist house in the woods?
Yeah, I mean, I think the house really, to me, separates them from nature, but in a kind of confusing way, because it's kind of, you know, they're inside in this space of music and books and Italian food that they can't eat. And yet they're surrounded by these trees, and it's not a house built from wood, it's built from glass, and it feels very kind of technological, where you compare that to the house where the wolf group congregate, and it's, you know, a modest wooden house that's much more built into the environment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the fact that it's glass, one of the things that I wonder is, are they kind of searching for prey as they're going around?
I mean, I thought that it was glass because normally they wouldn't be able to be exposed like that, but they've hidden themselves in the woods. And so they're kind of combining the privacy of the woods or the protection of the woods with the glass house.
Being on display almost in some way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the use of the woods. I mean, my favorite part of the movies overall was the setting because it's just so gorgeous. I think probably my favorite scene is the one where she rides on Edward's back and he takes her way up into the treetops.
Yeah, that's really beautiful when they end up. And it seems like the actors are, I was trying to decide if it was CGI, but it really seems like they are physically in a tree. I don't know if that's possible, but it was a beautiful shot. It really looks like they're up there, which reminds me of that novel we've been talking about, The Overstory, where there people live in the top of one of those trees. But yeah, I mean, I agree that the setting is really, it seems really important and somewhat underdeveloped in terms of its meaning. It gives you both the forest, which is this mysterious space, and a space of, you know, a space of fairy tales, a space of these battles between these epic creatures of vampires and werewolves, and a space where anything can happen when she goes into the forest. Like at one point her dad's like, why were you in the forest?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very much a space where anything can happen and where things really do happen to her. It's fairly remarkable what she experiences in the forest. And I was struck by the opening where the voiceover is talking about how she's never really thought about what would happen when you die, but how she'd like to die for someone that she cares about. But it's following this deer being chased through the woods by, it's unclear what predator, I guess probably a vampire, but I think it becomes a way of bringing humans into the, like she's, the humans are identified with animals in some ways, and kind of the shape shifting and all of that is enabled by the forest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of what I've been trying to get at is the importance of predators, how we see predators, and how that becomes a way of thinking about us as human beings, of trying to differentiate mm-hmm. ourselves in some ways, but also of identifying with animals. It seems to be this sort of mobile line of division, and the vampires are obviously a good example of that. It is the this business of calling themselves vegetarians because they don't feast on humans is pretty interesting.
Well, it's also interesting when you're thinking about predators to impose an idea of self-control and self-discipline, which might be a form of culture. You know, the Cullens are imposing a discipline on themselves that other vampires are not. And I think the werewolves, too, are concerned about how they're interacting with humans and with each other, and afraid of letting their predatory natures be unrestrained. So even within the predators, there seems to be some, at least in these films, some kind of reflection on, are we just predators, or can some kind of, maybe you want to call it culture, restrain those impulses?
Yeah. I guess one of the things that's interesting about the vampire as a predator is it speaks to the intimacy of predation. Dave and I have been watching the new David Attenborough series called Dynasties. I don't know if you've heard of that, but they follow families, or a pack of painted wolves was the last one that we watched, and they give them names. So there's this kind of personification that happens. There's some drama, you know, and you follow them over a period of time and see the dramas and the power struggles as they unfold. And as a result of that, you really identify with the animals in this intense way. And one of the things that strike me watching these hunt scenes is how intimate it is, you know, like when one animal is attacked and consumed by another, there's eye contact that happens, you know, it's very close and very physical. And the vampire is obviously in some ways a representation of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it's not like, I mean, the vampires seem to be happy with any human blood, but they also kind of fixate on Bella as a source of blood, like they're pursuing her specifically. So it really, they want her blood. Mm-hmm. So it really does seem specific in that way, the female vampire who's pursuing her. So yeah, I agree. And it's so sexualized in this movie too, that there are these stories that sexuality can be a metaphor for intimacy.
I hope you enjoyed our discussion. I'd be curious to hear what you think. Send me an email at askwith, again, that's askwith.intheweeds@gmail.com. Next time, I'll be talking to Rabbi Isaiah Rothstein about the creation story in Genesis. If you have a moment, please write a positive review in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and tell a friend to listen to the In the Weeds podcast. Thanks.